Okay, good afternoon. So last time we talked some about pipes and reading and writing. So you mentioned that when we read from things like pipes or a keyboard where input comes in over time, it's not like a file where everything, sorry, a regular file where everything is already there. When we do a read, well, read's going to give us what's there now. And a choice that POSIX made, because they felt it presumably was a more convenient interface, so if there's nothing there now, read is going to give you something, so it's going to wait for there to be something. But if there is something there, it's not going to wait for the full thing you could possibly have read to fill up. They're going to give you something right away. And you can imagine the justification for this, because this usually matches what you want to do if you have a program that gets input from the keyboard or the network. You want to get some input and process it if there is some. If there is none, you probably don't want to just have read tell you, sorry, try again. You'd rather it wait. So that's the interface POSIX shows. Could have chosen a different one, but probably what they chose is what most programmers would prefer, and therefore is sort of the most common thing you'll see. Mention that when we actually do reach the end of some input, read returns zero. This indicates end of file. This is not the same as nothing's available right now. This is there's no more stuff that will ever be available. So for a pipe, this means that no one can write to the pipe anymore. And for like a file, or for like a network, it means that no one can write to over the network anymore. Then we talked a bit about pipes. We mentioned sort of the implementation of pipe is that, well, it has some storage. So if you write something, it can be the case that you can write it without it being read right away. But there's a limitation to that. The system's not going to just store like many gigabytes of data that haven't been read yet. And they decided that they don't want to do something like have the write fail, so they'll have the write wait for someone to read the data. And this is usually what we want. If you think of our pipeline, where we're like running one command and having another command process its output, we'd probably want the command that's writing the output to wait for that other command to catch up. And that's what this achieves. We also mentioned a common mispattern with pipe is that, well, each time you call pipe, it makes a new pipe. You can have as many as you like. Well, not quite as many as you like, but because we have a finite number of file descriptors, but you have a whole lot. And in particular, if you're calling pipe with fork, you have to remember, well, if I have fork, I run some code twice. So if you run a call to pipe twice, you'll get two different pipes. And it might not be obvious immediately that they're two different pipes, but they are. Then we started talking about scheduling, and we looked at particular how XV6 handled the actual scheduling process. So earlier in the semester, we looked at, oh, context switches work like this, and we had this view that, oh, XV6, we're done writing a program for some reason, like a timer interrupt happened, or the program just doesn't have anything to do anymore, we're going to switch to another program. And there's some switch function which switches from one stack to another that we learned about. And XV6 actually does something a little more convoluted, that we have a separate thread that runs the scheduler. And the scheduler is just running this loop where it looks for something to run and then switches to it. And that thing, when it wants to run something else, it doesn't switch directly to the something else, it switches to the scheduler thread so it can go back to looking for the next thing to run and switch to it. And this is a design that XV6 chose because it's probably more convenient to program. In particular, they have like this loop in the scheduler thread that they just continue when you switch to it, which has some local variables. And that's handled because we always have its own stack and all that to manage that. If we didn't do this, like many OSs, don't have this design, well, we'd have to keep track of that information more explicitly. We'd have to somehow have code which can go back to what's our current status and figure out where we are in the loop and find the next thing. And many OSs do that because it avoids a context switch. But XV6 is generally, when there's a compromise between simpler to program and more efficient, they're choosing simpler to program. So that's not what they do. And we mentioned, okay, so we're looking for something to run. How do we figure out what to run? Well, we have to track what things are runnable. And in XV6, the way we've chosen to do that is we have this state variable in our thread control block, which we learned was the struct proc, which says if something is ready to run, is actually running right now, or is waiting for something else to happen. And when we want to figure out what is ready, running, or waiting for some purpose, like we went to look for some, the next thing that's ready to run, we just scan through that table. And as I mentioned, this is not the most efficient solution, simplest to code, but a more efficient solution, we keep this information in something where we could do a lookup that wasn't a linear search. Okay, so and last time we were finished up, we talked about scheduling metrics. I'll pick up on that next, but before I get on to that, questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so we learned how the XV6 scheduler worked, and we wanted to say, is it doing a good thing, or the best thing, or the worst thing? And we have these three metrics that are among those we can talk about. So one of these is turnaround time. This is the time from when someone, when some I/O is ready for a program to process to when it finishes processing it. So causative example is key press to the program actually output something for you to see. And we call this turnaround time. That's the term I'll use. You'll also see in Anderson-Dahlin response time. I'm going to use turnaround time because response time sometimes means some other similar things, and turnaround time doesn't. We also are going to talk about throughput. So throughput is the total work per second. And by work, I mean stuff the programs we're running do. So for this purpose, we're going to say that all the stuff we're doing to actually manage the programs, that's, from the program's perspective, useless. If they had the CPU to themselves, we wouldn't be doing any of this context switch nonsense and scanning the process table. All the extra time we're spending because of that, that's not useful work. And so the throughput is about sort of the ratio between that, what we get running alone and the actual work that gets done. And we'll call the extra stuff overhead. We also have fairness, and fairness, from last time, there's many different definitions, but we sort of have an intuitive notion, and sort of a way you might think about fairness in the way that some definitions of fairness work is we can say, if we look at the thread that has the sort of worst performance in some aspect, how bad is it? And sort of the fairest thing makes that the least bad. That's one way we could view sort of the fairness problem. There's some other definitions we could imagine. So we mentioned that we're dealing with scheduling CPU bursts. So if we're thinking about turnaround time and CPU bursts, sort of the turnaround time is the time from when we finish one I/O operation to when we start the next one. And the sum of those times if we have multiple of them. And that's sort of what we're going to focus on if we're thinking about turnaround time as our metric. Looked at throughput last time, useful time. And something I want to mention about throughput is that sort of here I've kind of shown our context, which is just we spend some amount of time switching from one program to another. In practice, the big issue with context switches is not the actual time we're spending, like changing stack pointers and storing and saving registers, which does take some significant amount of time, but is time lost to things like cold caches. So when we're running program A, it's going to put stuff in the cache that's going to be nice and fast to access. And then we switch to program B, and B is going to put different stuff in the cache. And when we switch back to A, it's going to run slower than it would if we didn't do those context switches. And that's a much bigger effect. And sort of one of the bigger concerns about why we'd lose throughput from having a scheduler running other things. Yes? Doesn't A and B have different caches? No. So in this example, I'm assuming a single core. That was sort of our assumption. And that single core has a set of caches. And generally, we're going to have those caches be all available to the currently running program. There are schemes that some real OSs have used where we try to split them up in some way, but that is not a common thing. But it might be a good idea. But yeah, but it's not very common, at least not for the level one caches. And we mentioned fairness. Sort of, you know, we have some intuitive notion that probably this is more fair, but it might depend on our definition and, like, when can B or A actually run and things like that. So, that in mind, let's do a little exercise here. So here I have a program A, B, and C. And program A here has this pattern where it wants to use the CPU for, you know, basically 2 units of time. Then it does something on the network, which takes some amount of time, where it can't run on the CPU, and then it wants to run again. Program B just has something to run, and program C has something that's longer to run. And we're assuming initially they're all ready to run. And my question is, which of these schedules is better by for throughput, for mean turnaround time, for fairness, or for if I ask a user, does this make my system responsive, which one do you think, you know, would be the best sort of approach? Give you a minute, you can check with your neighbor, see if you agree. So turnaround time is the time from when we start running, so when we're runnable, so when something has finished that lets us run with, for all these processes, they're runnable initially, to when we finish running. And so the mean would be you sum them all up and divide. So something worth noting is that optimizing mean turnaround time, same thing as optimizing total. Because assuming we have the same number of things happening, which in this case is going to be true. Yes. Turnaround time count when the program start. What was? Turnaround time is based on when the process is ready. If we were just saying when it was running, that would not be a very interesting metric for users, right? Which is sort of our goal is like turnaround time kind of represents, you know, what happens when I like press a key, how soon do I see an answer? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with throughput. Who thinks one has the best throughputs? Okay, two and three. Okay, and who thinks two has the worst throughputs? about three. Okay, so we have good consensus about throughput, and context switches are usually our biggest thing. There's some other things that we couldn't tell from this, like, is it more complicated to figure out what to run next? But seems like probably for throughput, you know, the first one is the right example there. Okay, so mean turnaround time. Who thinks one is best for mean turnaround time? Okay, two, three. Okay, so we have more of a split here. So let's calculate turnaround times. So turnaround time. So B is ready starting here and finishes here. So this is sort of one unit for B. A is ready starting here and finishes here. So that's basically three units for A the first time. And the second time, it's ready starting here and finishes here. So that's basically two units. And C is ready at the beginning, finishes here. So that is basically seven units. So our throughput is 1 plus 5 plus 7, so 13 over, our mean turnaround time is 13 over 3, basically. For 2, A is ready starting here and finishes here the first time, so that's 4 units plus 1 unit the second time. So it's sort of total turnaround time is the same both times. B is ready starting here, finishes there. So its turnaround time is 2 instead of 1. And C is the same. It starts, it's ready at the same time and finishes at the same time, and there's no sort of period where it's doing I/O. So C has 7 units of turnaround time. So this is 2 plus 5 plus 7, which is 14. Over 3, sorry. 3. Still it's over 3. Same number of things happen. So by turnaround time, the first one is better. Questions and how I came to that conclusion. Yes? Our assumption is all programs are ready in the beginning. We have evidence that that must be true for A and B based on the schedules. They wouldn't make sense otherwise. And, you know, I'm telling you it's true for C. Other questions? Yeah.
This is more of a general question than about this particular exercise, but is there like a practical reason that we would actually want to prioritize fairness? Is there any way that fairness would actually reflect in the user experience?
Question, is there a practical reason we would have to prioritize fairness? We will have an example later in the class. That will demonstrate why we care. Other questions? Okay, so how about fairness? So which one of these is better for fairness? Who thinks one has best fairness? We have a couple people, okay. 2, 3. Okay, so you all think fairness is best for 3. And I think the argument is that, oh, it seems like, you know, in all the other cases, like we're kind of mean to C. And I think that that's not like a crazy argument. I think by most definitions of fairness, I would say 1 is better. And the reason why is let's look at what happens to poor B. B here isn't run for so long, which hurts its performance both in terms of like does it get the CPU when it's able to versus other threads, or does it, you know, get the finish, you know, at a reasonable time compared to other threads, given how much work it has to do. So, as I said, fairness definitions vary. I think under most definitions of fairness, we'd say there's a problem here that B is scheduled really unfairly here in 3. And that's the sort of thing you want to look for when you're thinking about fairness. Usually, that's usually what the definitions are based on, is like, you know, what's the worst we're treating a thread, and how can we make that not so bad? And it seems like, you know, in Schedule 3, we've chosen to treat thread B really poorly compared to A and C. And compared to all the other schedules, like here, like at least, you know, in all the other schedules, A, B, and C get to start running earlier than we delay poor B in Schedule 3. And also, you know, at least some, you know, something gets to finish earlier. So I think by most metrics, but, I, you know, it's not, like, insane to say it might be more fair, but I don't think it's, you know, not the typical way you measure fairness, because you want to say something about what's wrong with what we're doing to be here. So questions, comments on that idea? Okay, I have this worked out on a slide for everything but fairness. Okay, so on the schedules.
Can you explain the use?
Oh, user-perceived responsiveness. I didn't even ask about that, right, which I should. Okay, so let's talk about user-perceived responsiveness. Who thinks one should be better for that? Two. Three. Okay, so we have a split. And I would say, like, I think it's probably not a very fair question because we want more information, right? So my simplest heuristic for what's best for user-perceived responsiveness is I think about when a program is waiting for input from, sorry, it just got input from a user, how fast is it going to produce output? And turnaround time kind of matches to that, because, you know, usually when I give input to a program, it's going to become runnable as a result of that, and I want it to finish running and therefore have produced any output as soon as possible. And turnaround time reflects that. But you could have an argument that maybe some of these programs aren't really doing that, right? That if I think of the programs I care about responsiveness for, maybe they're the programs that are very short. You know, when I press a key, they do something very quickly. I want to make that really quick, but the things that are going to take many seconds, like, I don't care about the difference between, you know, 2 seconds and 3 seconds. So maybe the turnaround time metric is not the right one, and we need something more sophisticated, and that's a reasonable assumption. Or you might say, you know, you might have been looked at three and said, you know, yes, this is not very fair to B, but, you know, at least this makes sure A finishes as soon as possible. And, you know, we're kind of squeezing in B when A and C aren't running, and we should prioritize these longer A's and C's that might be the things I'm really waiting for, not, you know, whatever B is. Because B maybe is, even though it takes longer, maybe it doesn't take longer enough that I'm going to care. So there's some subjectivity with what user perceived, right? Responsiveness, and that may not be reflected by these metrics. And that's sort of a thing OSs need to worry about, is that, you know, you can come up with nice, clean, optimizable metrics, which we will, and typically, the actual scheduling goals are not so easily stated cleanly. And you need to do some work to figure out, you know, what actually matches what a user will say is your system performs well. So questions, comments? Not. Yeah. That is just a typo. And it's, should be 6, 7, 7. Right? Yeah, 7. Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 context switches. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah. So why would which be the best for responsiveness? So I think you can make an argument that 2 is better for perceived responsiveness. It doesn't optimize the average turnaround time metric. And if we, so for example, that means that if we think A is something that I'm a user is waiting for, well, we ran it slower than the other schedules. Right? And that would be a way that might not be optimal. Other questions? Okay. So now that we have sort of some idea about scheduling metrics, I'm going to look at the 2 most simple scheduling algorithms that we can possibly think of. And I'm going to start with, you know, the first one here, which is the simplest possible one. And we're going to show some examples under some nice simplifying assumptions. We're going to assume that we have multiple programs that are ready at almost the same time. So we have a bunch of things that we could possibly run and we need to choose. The scheduling problem isn't very interesting otherwise. And you can think of this as maybe what really happened is I was running some other program before I decided to switch away from it, and while that was running, a bunch of other programs became ready. And I'm going to assume that they're in some order. And this would just sort of happen naturally because, well, if we were keeping a list of the programs that were ready, we'd add to the list. The list has to be in some order when we iterate over it. Or in XV6, we have a table of processes. Something's first in the table, something's last. Right? So there's some order to this, which is going to become relevant because that's how we're going to basically, you know, do what's most convenient, which is, you know, next thing on the list. So I'm going to look at first come, first served. Simplest scheduling algorithm. And we're going to not do preemptions. So we're going to run a program, and we're not going to interrupt it. We're just run it until it can't run anymore. So this is simpler than what XV6 does. We're just going to keep running the program until it does it and doesn't want to run anymore. So what does this look like? Well, depends the order things arrive. So I have my example here. I have 3 threads. And remember, these all become runnable at the same time, or like before they got added to the queue, and then we were asked to run something new. And I'm going to say that A needs about 24 units of time, and B and C need 4 and 3. And you can think that this indicates that A is something that does a lot of computation, and B and C are probably more interactive. We don't know this for sure. But this is sort of, you know, what we'd expect, is that things that are more about processing inputs quickly probably have short CPU bursts. Things that are doing more computation probably have longer ones. And if they arrive in order A, B, C, this is the schedule we'll get. So we're in A for its full 24 units, then B, then C, and I'm assuming context switches don't take any time, but you know that's not really true. And this gives us a turnaround time mean of 27.7. We have 24 units for A from when it became runnable at time 0, and 28 units for B, and 31 units for C. If we think of the arrival order BCA, you know, we get a very different answer, that we have 31 units of turnaround time for A, so a bunch longer, but B and C are much shorter. So there's just a lot of luck as far as who actually is first on our list. And a notable thing which might not be so great about this first come first served policy is that we have this, what's, you know, sometimes called a convoy effect, where commonly a bunch of threads will wait for something that takes a long time. And that seems like it's probably not so great. That we have 2 tasks which we could finish very quickly, which we aren't running because we're waiting for something else that just randomly happened to be first. So questions about the first come, first serve policy? Yes? What program is first is pretty much random. So it's not part of the scheduling policy. So how that would happen would often not be random. So like in XV6, like the process table is filled in by looking for the first entry that's unused, and that would determine ordering if we were doing this sort of policy on XV6. In other systems, it might be which, you know, there might be, you know, they might have all become runnable at very slightly different times. It's a common thing. So like one became runnable, you know, you pressed a key at one point in time and a network packet came in at another, and it depends on the ordering of that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What if you have to wait for input? So when you become runnable, you get added to the list. And usually in this policy, you get added to the end of the list. Yeah, and that's when you'll be able to run. Okay, so that's our simplest policy. And we're going to talk about the next simplest policy, which was called round robin. And this is the simplest algorithm with preemption, meaning that we will stop programs from running if they ran for too long. So we're going to run the program until it can't run anymore. So that's the same as first come, first served. Or it runs for too long and exceeds a time quantum. We're going to assign some amount of time the program is allowed to run, which I will call its time quantum. And when it stops running, you know, runs for that long, we will run the next thing on the list and put the program back on the end of the list. So implementing this, it's more complicated because we need a way to like stop programs in the middle. We saw XV6 has a timer interrupt which can do that. And we need a way to like switch away from programs that haven't prepared themselves to switch away. We saw XV6's context switch, you know, it will stop a program that's in the middle of a loop that has no code related to waiting for something else to happen. So XV6 supports these sort of building blocks, and this is in fact kind of by accident XV6's scheduling policy. So I'm going to show what round robin looks like, assuming we choose a particular time quantum. And you might say, I told you this is XV6's scheduling policy, but does XV6 really make this decision? And the answer is kind of. So XV6 has this timer interrupt, which goes off every so many milliseconds that it configures at boot. And it just switches when that timer interrupt happens without regard to when the program actually started. So if you start right near a timer interrupt, you'll get switched away from quickly. I'm going to show examples where I assume we like start a new timer each time just to make it easy for me to make diagrams. But you know, the conclusions are going to be very similar either way. And here I've chosen a time quantum of 1 unit, and I have sort of the same example I had before. I have my really long A CPU burst and B and C. And you can see that we're going to run A for a little bit. It's going to exceed that 1 unit time quantum. We'll go to the next thing in the list, which is B, then C, and then we'll go back to A and so on. So it's called round robin because we did go around in a circle, basically running everyone until they're done. And you can see a nice thing about the round robin policy is I've gotten rid of that very heavy dependence on the order that we happen to choose. That I get very similar results as far as turnaround time no matter which order it is. Okay, so questions about round robin? So, yes. So when we calculate turnaround times, do we always assume the time to switch is just negligible? No, but these examples are assuming that, but you know, we can still calculate turnaround times if we know context switch amount of times, right? It just means that we'll finish at a different time. And we'll take that into account in our calculation. Yes?
So does it know that there's no other programs to run, or does it every 1 second interrupt?
So question, does it know that there's no other programs to run, or does it interrupt it every second? So it could know. So an implementation that was sort of probably optimal could realize, oh, there's nothing more to run. Let me unschedule timer interrupts. Let me tell the timer hardware, don't trigger. XV6 doesn't do this, which means that there's extra scheduling overhead, where it will run the scheduler to find out, oh, need to go back to A. It's still the same policy. It's just a less efficient implementation. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so here I arbitrarily chose that our time quantum is one unit. Often we might want to choose something else, and that will result in a slightly different schedule. So in this example, I chose a time quantum of 2, so I run A for 2 units, then B, then C, then A, then B. And when I try to run C the next time, well, I let it run for 2 units, but it doesn't use all of them. After 1 unit of time, it's done. And so I'm not going to run nothing. I'm going to run A because it's the only thing I can run. Questions about sort of what happens with our larger time quantum here? Yeah?
Would that make the time quantum reset after like 1 second of C, or is it still
there? Question, would this make the time quantum reset after 1 second of C? So in the examples I will give, I will assume that, you know, if we had like something besides A to run, that we'd run, you know, we'd switch between that and A for 2 units of time afterwards, which would typically be how you design this. But that's not what, like, say, XV6 does, just because XV6, you know, didn't care about making the time quantum very consistent. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we're gonna choose, yeah, and these have, you know, almost the same turnaround time still. So we're gonna choose a time quantum. Something we need to think about is, well, what number should we choose? It probably matters. You know, how do we know what a good choice is? And then we're gonna switch after the time quantum expires, or, you know, when the program is done anyways. And for thinking about what it means to choose a particular time quantum, one thing I can, you know, approach I can have is I can think about, what if we make the time quantum really, really, really large? If we make the time quantum 1,000 or 1,000,000, then as long as nothing has a CPU burst over 1,000,000 units, we're gonna have the same policy we started out with when we talked about first come, first serve. We're never gonna have something run out of time. We're just gonna have that first come, first serve policy. So we can kind of think of a spectrum here, that when we make the quantum shorter and shorter, we're going to have this more of this switching rapidly between everything that's runnable policy. We make it longer and longer, we get to that first come first served thing, where we can have that convoy effect again. And if we think in terms of our metrics, well, with a shorter quantum, we're doing all that switching. So we have lots more context switches, so our throughput is likely to be lower. We're doing more work to switch between processes to figure out what to run. Versus, you know, sort of first come, first serve, we have the minimum number of context switches we could possibly have because we only run everything, you know, we run everything as long as it can run. But if we think of fairness, the order didn't matter. We aren't favoring one program over another in any way, real way with round robin with a short quantum. You know, runs always consistently, so it's fair, at least in some sense of fair. Maybe it's not the sense of fair you were thinking of when I asked about fairness in the exercise. But there's some idea of fairness that we're providing that first come, first serve doesn't, where first come, first serve just arbitrarily says if you get on the list, you know, a millisecond earlier, you get to run forever versus someone who doesn't. And so we can kind of adjust the amount of fairness with that. So questions about this spectrum? Yes. The closer we are to round robin with the shortest possible time quantum, the worse our throughput is. Yeah. So in practice, we're probably not going to choose a point between the shortest possible time quantum, you know, that's larger than that. In fact, I'll get to that on the next slide. So other questions? Okay. So something you may notice is missing here is I haven't talked about turnaround time. We'll get to that later. But for fairness and throughput, we have this trade-off that we're making by choosing our time quantum. And one thing we want to kind of quantify is, well, how bad is that, you know, throughput issue? And that's often like the big thing that OSs are thinking of when they choose a time quantum. I mean, this is true for round robin and also schemes that aren't the round robin policy but also have time quantums. Because even if we aren't doing round robin where we just take the next thing, we have a scheme where we limit the amount of time something can run, you know, and decide to do a context switch, we're going to have the same sort of trade-off. Shorter time quantum, more switches, longer, less switches. And to think about that, we usually need to know, well, how long does a context switch really take? And by and large, the big cost of a context switch is what often might be called indirect costs. So direct costs of a context switch are like, I have to change the stack pointer. I have to copy all the registers somewhere. You know, I have to switch from kernel to user mode and user to kernel mode. And those all things all take time. But in terms of real program performance, that's not the biggest issue with doing context switches. The biggest issue is that if I run a program alone, it gets to use all the caches on the processor and has them all ready and set up when it's running, you know, after some little startup period. If I switch to the program, well, all those caches are not set up anymore. And it's going to run slower for a while until they do. And when we include that indirect cost, the measured cost of a context switch empirically is kind of like a hundredth to a tenth of a millisecond. It depends on what the program is doing. That's sort of what people have measured, that sort of range. And generally, when operating systems choose how long are we going to let a program run before we switch to something else for round robin or any similar policy, they're going to look at managing that overhead. So for example, Linux has chosen 0.75 milliseconds to 6 milliseconds as its default sort of range of time quantum it will choose. You know, and that's sort of making a statement about what overheads are okay. That if we choose something that's sort of in the, you know, 1 millisecond range, we're saying 1 to 10% overhead is fine. Meaning we can have our programs run 1 to 10% slower in order to not let something run for too long, to have those other nice things that we might get, you know, by deviating from the first come, first serve policy, like that fairness and possibly something better for turnaround time, but we'll get to that later. And historically, I've seen like things all range from like 1 millisecond to 100, you know, depends on, well, how much slower you can handle the system being versus how much you really care about things like fairness and being able to run things quickly. So questions on context switch overhead? Okay, so let's think about turnaround time, and I'll ask you the question. So let's assume there's no context switch overhead, because that really complicates things. And just say, you know, if context switches are free, what would round robin do for turnaround time? Would it decrease it, increase it, or increase it, or decrease it, you know, depending on the scenario? And I have stay the same an option, and that's because it's possible to have it stay the same in some very trivial ways. So a trivial example is if there's only one program and there's no context switch overhead, well, it doesn't really matter what your time quantum is. You're just going to keep running that as long as it can run. I advise checking with your neighbors to see if you agree on. Sir. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see. Who thinks A should decrease crystallization? B, increase crystallization? Okay. And C, could do either. Okay, so we have most consensus for could do either. So I have some sort of simple examples for, yes, it could do either. So let's start with increasing. The simplest example I could come up with is, let's say we have two things which need the same amount of time and they both become ready at the same time or basically the same time. In that case, if we have a 1 unit time quantum here, they know if they're 1 unit of time, or in one, it will have a turnaround time of one, or in the other, it will have a turnaround time of two, because it's been waiting for 1 unit, and then it runs for 1 unit, and it gives us a mean turnaround time of 1.5 units. If we set the time quantum to half a unit of time, we run one, then the other, then one, then the other, and both of them take longer to finish, despite being ready at the same time. Some questions about this example? Okay. If we decrease it, if we can decrease the turnaround time, here's an example of that. So here, my first example, I have A needs 10 units of time, and B needs one, and we happen to have A first on our list, some bad luck. And what's going to happen with, if the time quantum is 10 units, this will run all of A. You know, we just do the first come, first serve thing. So we get 10.5, that B needs 11 units of time to finish, even though it only had 1 unit of work. Whereas if we make the time quantum shorter, we'll at least stick B in the middle of A, and we'll have a shorter overall time. Some questions? This example. And I mentioned that I could stay the same. I gave the very trivial example. If we're only running one thing, of course it won't change anything. It can also stay the same with running two different things. So let's say A needs 1 unit, B needs 1 unit, my time quantum's 10. It's going to be the same as if my time quantum's 5 or 1. So it can stay the same in a bunch of other cases. So this tells us that playing around with the time quantum is probably not actually a good way to optimize turnaround time. So we're going to need to do some other aspect of scheduling. And what we're going to look at is ordering. That, you know, it's not switching more often or less often is not going to solve our problem. We need to think about the order. And when we saw first come, first serve, we saw arrival order really mattered. And let's see how that affected turnaround time. And if we look at all the possible orders for our original example, well, our highest turnaround time is the ABC order, and our lowest is the CBA order. And this is not a coincidence. This is, you know, because if we order things by how long they need to run, that's going to be best. And what's an intuition for why that happens? So if I think of this first example, when I run A, I'm making two things wait for that entire amount of time. Versus if I run C, I'm still making two things wait, but I'm making them wait for only 3 units of time instead of 24. And that gives me the intuition that if I want to have things wait the fewest, I should run the shortest possible thing so less things are waiting. Basically, I want to make less things be waiting as fast as possible. The way I do that is I run whatever thing will finish fastest when I run it. And so that gives me this order, that the order I want to run things in for turnaround time is CBN. And that, in fact, will optimize the turnaround time. We can get the best turnaround time by running the shortest CPU burst first. We can get the worst if we wanted to do that by running the longest first. And you can kind of think of this as we want to this race to go to sleep, that we want to make things stop waiting to run and start waiting for something else as soon as possible. We have them go to sleep waiting for I.O., like a key press or something, as fast as possible. So that's what we'll do. And later we'll talk about a scheduler that takes advantage of this. And you can probably guess what the policy is. There's going to be some details we'll have to think about. the two big ones are, one, what happens when things become ready? So we've kind of been assuming so far that, you know, things become ready all at the same time. That's obviously not really true, and we're going to need to consider that, you know, how that changes our policy. And also, you might observe that we don't actually know how long CPU bursts are in practice. Like, I'm telling you this, but it's not like when you're writing a C program, you say, here's my C program, it has 10 millisecond CPU bursts. You don't say that, so how does the OS know this? And the answer is it doesn't, it guesses, and we'll see how. But first, I'm gonna have a diversion into some other scheduling policies that is gonna be useful for going back to the scheduling policy we actually want. And I'm gonna talk about a different sort of scheduling goal. So let's say I am writing a shared system and people can log into the system, and some people log into the system and like use an interactive shell, and some people log into the system and run some big computation, you know, or some long compile. And I, as a system administrator, have decided that I would really like people's shells to be responsive. I don't want it to be the case that when someone's running a big computation, that all the users who are trying to do things on their shell complain about this to me. So I want to give priority to those shell things over those big computations. Or alternately, you know, I run, you know, IT for a department, and the faculty are my bosses, not the students, so I'm gonna make sure the faculty stuff runs well so they don't complain. You know, so maybe I want to prioritize their programs over others. So there's a scheduling algorithm for this called priority scheduling. We're gonna set priority levels. In this example, I've chosen to have 16, and we're gonna put our threads into those priority levels. And we'll have a separate queue of ready processes for each level. And whenever we need to run a new process, we'll look at the highest priority queue and try to run something there. If there's nothing there, we'll go to the next one and so on. And in this example, I've chosen that highest priority is priority 15, lowest priority is priority 0. And if there's multiple processes in that priority, we can use whatever other scheduling algorithm we want to decide between. We could do round robin, we could do first come, first served, or we could do something where we say we're just gonna assign different priorities for every thread. So this is sort of the same sort of idea as this, you know, round robin, first come, first served, except when we have to choose what to run next, we're gonna run the thing that's the highest priority that's runnable. And an important point of this is that generally this is gonna be preemptive, meaning that when a higher priority comes along, it's gonna take over the CPU over a lower priority thing. So part of implementing priority scheduling is gonna be that whenever a program becomes runnable, we're gonna check, is it higher priority than the thing that's currently running? And if so, we're gonna run it instead. Because that would kind of defeat our point of our policy that, you know, the shell is more important if we don't actually run the shell right away when it can run. So we're always gonna do that. That's gonna be part of our policy. So this is, for example, not what XV6 does. When XV6, when you, you know, like press a key, it marks the process as runnable. It doesn't actually run it until the scheduler runs normally. But with priority scheduling, that's not the thing you want to do. You want to run it right away to make sure that higher priority thing gets to run right now. So let's think about what this policy does. So let's say I have two processes. I have a process with thread A, which is at the highest priority, and it does this pattern where it does some I/O for one unit of time, like something with a network or a disk, and then does 10 units of computation, then does one time unit of I/O, then 10 units of computation, so on indefinitely. And I have a thread Z at the lowest priority that needs 4,000 units of CPU and does no I/O. My question is, how long will it take thread Z to complete? If you, a couple minutes, check with your neighbors. How long will thread Z take? Assume we have one core, like all our examples so far. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so someone wanted to volunteer an answer for me? Anyone? Yes. 44,000. So how did you get that? Yeah, so you're saying we'll run A for 10 units of time, and then A will run some IO for 1 unit of time, and in that time, that's when we can run B. There's no other time B is allowed to run, because at all the other times, A is running and has higher priority. Is runnable, I should say, and has higher priority, and therefore will run. Questions on how to come up with that answer? Okay, so let's do a variant of this. Let's say I have a thread B, which has the same pattern as A at the second highest priority now. Now how long does E take? Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so does someone have an answer for me? Yes?
Z never starts.
Okay, so you're saying Z never starts, so why?
Because A will run for 10 seconds, and then when it's doing its IO, B will run for 1 second until A finishes its IO, take back over to CPU, run A for 10 seconds, and you just alternate back and forth between A and B with that.
Yes, and so you might say, okay, so wait a moment, doesn't B do IO too? And yes. And if things are exactly synced up, when B starts its IO is exactly when A is going to start running again. If things aren't exactly synced up, maybe there will be a little teeny bit of time for Z to run. But basically, Z will take essentially forever. Like, we need to get really lucky and have it such that somehow, you know, when A, you know, starts its... somehow that Z like finishes its computation sort of out of sync halfway in between A's IO period, so Z gets a little bit of a chance to run, and that's no guarantee that will even ever happen if things are timed, you know, as you might be suggested here. So this problem is known as starvation, that programs can get starved of resources. They can never get to get the resources they want. because of things of higher priority. This is a thing which just happens with priority scheduling. It's what you asked for. You said these are more important, and priority scheduling did that for you. And so it said, it's more important, so I'm going to follow that, and I'm not going to run Z. And this is a big motivation that I alluded to, we talk about later, about why you want a fairness metric. Because if you don't have a fairness metric, things like this are going to happen. So if you don't think about fairness, you will have, you know, schedulers that optimize something that is important to you and starve a program. And usually, you know, even if we're thinking about like the students and faculty or the shells versus computation scenario, that's not what you actually were intending when you enacted that policy. You know, your intention of prioritizing faculty was probably not that students can't use the machine at all. Your intention of prioritizing shells over computation probably wasn't that you can't run that long compile at all in the machine. But that's what you'll achieve quite often. That's why you might want a fair scheduler. So we're going to talk a little about fair scheduling and lead into our assignment after shell. And there's a lot of ways of defining fairness, and I'm going to sort of think of one intuition that we're going to think of is that every thread has an equal chance to be chosen. That's a kind of fairness, and that seems like very intuitive, like it has sort of a natural explanation that of why everything is being treated equally. Okay, so this gives us a scheduling algorithm that, you know, let's just, when we need to choose something to run, choose at random, just uniformly for everything. It's good for fairness, it's bad for everything else, but it certainly is fair. And, you know, this is kind of the opposite of our priority scheme, right? We're saying everything is equally important, and you might say, couldn't we have some sort of compromise between that? Like, I'd like to say that some programs, like shells, I really want to run better than the other programs. And we can think of a variation of this scheme that tries to take that into account, known as proportional share. You know, we'll say that, say, thread A is twice as important as B. So one idea is that we should run thread A twice as much as B. So how can we do that? We can make a weighted random choice. That we can choose randomly between A and B, but we can do so in a way where we give A twice as many chances as B. So it's not the priority situation. We don't say we're never choosing B. We just limit how often we choose B in some controlled way. And this is a scheduler you're going to implement for the next assignment, which is the lottery assignment. So that's sort of how we're going to view it. So that we're going to say that threads kind of have these lottery tickets. So each thread has a range of numbers on their lottery tickets. And we want to schedule a thread. We choose one of those numbers. That's who gets to run. And in this example, I've chosen that B is twice as important as A and twice as important as C. So it has twice as many lottery tickets. That means when I want to figure out what to run, I'm going to run B half the time, A a quarter of the time, and C a quarter of the time. And I can adjust this to get closer to fairness, so I can make the ticket numbers closer to even to get a fair schedule, or I can make the ticket numbers further apart to get something closer and closer to priority. So like if I make the ticket numbers, you know, something like 1,000,000, 1,001, that's basically priority scheduling. Then I can implement a different policy with the same thing by just choosing different numbers of tickets. And importantly, I can kind of interpolate in between those, right? I can choose at all these sorts of points in between, and that's sort of what's elegant about this solution. So there's some things which aren't elegant, which we'll talk about next time. So one big thing that's not elegant about this is that I'm telling you we're making a random choice. And we can make that random choice efficiently. We're not going to have you do that for the assignment, but I promise you can. But even when you do that, it's bad for predictability, right? That we're literally choosing things at random, it's going to happen differently every time. And that might not be what you want. So we might talk about, briefly, about sort of things that are similar to this idea that are maybe a little more deterministic and consistent. So I think for syncing with the other section, that's probably where I'll leave off. I'll take questions, though. Questions on lot registration. Yes? The difference between uniformly at random and random? I'm just specifying, because it's very important for this, for uniform, that we have an equal chance of choosing everything versus, you know, the choices we're making with these different numbers of tickets. They're random, but they're deliberately not uniform. Yes? Still do the round robin? So, yes, yeah, so this lottery idea that I've introduced it is independent of the timing. So we're going to do it on top of round robin. Sort of as originally proposed, they had some ideas about trying to adjust time slices. We're not going to deal with that, but you could imagine, you could say, maybe we should do something about what if I choose to run something and it doesn't need as much time as something else. So the people who originally proposed this scheme in the academic literature talked about adjustments to handle that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that's where I'll leave off. See you next week.